to let our younger people know what it was like in the early days, how we were beaten up by the gangsters and the underworld goons, and how we were shot at, and how we were intimidated. But we overcame all of that power of these great corporations, and we demonstrated that when free men and women are united in the solidarity of human brotherhood, when they are united by common commitment in pursuit of common objectives, that there is no power in the world that can stop the forward march of free men thus united.
Hello, this is Arthur Bush, and you're listening to Radio Free Flint. Thank you for joining us today. Today, our episode, Midnight in the Vehicle City, The Legacy of Flint's Auto Workers, centers around the 1937 sit-down strike in the city of Flint. The author, Edward McClellan, is from East Lansing, Michigan. He joins us to talk about his book, Midnight in the Vehicle City, is a good review of the history of the Flint sit-down strike. What might be the legacy of the 1937 strike all these many years later, how it's continued to be remembered, and what it means for the future of Flint. Edward, welcome to Radio Free Flint. It's an honor to have you. Why did you write this book?
I decided it would be, you know, more interesting, maybe more exciting to just write about one incident. And I settled on the sit-down strike, partly because one of our old family friends, a guy named Everett Ketchum, who's mentioned in the book, he was a sit-down striker, and he was one of the last, if not the last, survivors of the sit-down strike. He died in 2013 at age 98. To me, he just exemplified the victories of the strikers. You know, he started out as an apprentice making 25 cents an hour, and he retired as a tool and die maker in the 70s making, you know, $27 an hour. And he had that GM lifetime health care, which is probably one reason he lived so long. You know, he was certainly an inspiration for writing the book. I mean, I really benefited from the fact that in the late 70s and early 80s, a guy at U of M Flint named Neil Layton, he conducted oral histories with the sit-down strikers. But they had dozens and dozens of interviews. Some of them are online at the U of M Flint Labor History Project, but a lot of them were just in boxes at the Thompson Library, I think at the Genesee County Historical Collection. So I spent a couple days just, you know, making photocopies. That allowed me to tell the story of the strike, you know, from the, you know, the voice of the striker. And I think one reason it's such a great story is, you know, you've got, not only do you have those people, but I mean, it was a story that involved people up to the very highest levels of society. It involved, you know, the governor of Michigan, Frank Murphy, and the president of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He even got involved. He had to call a GM executive to convince them to negotiate with the sit-down strikers. GM's place in the corporate hierarchy or the American hierarchy was at that time, maybe still is, so grand that they were not going to take orders from anybody but the president himself. Roosevelt had to call William Knudsen.
Well, they had C.S. Mott that lived in Flint, who sat on the board of General Motors.
Right. I don't think he was really, I didn't write anything about him. I don't know how much he was involved in this or if he was involved at all. But I mean, obviously,
I've been trying to find that out.
Yeah, obviously, you know, Flint is the hometown of General Motors, you know, where General Motors was founded. It was where William Durant lived and where he put all the companies together that made up GM.
The research that you did was from these interviews that you conducted. Some are actually oral, so you can listen to them on the internet. And some you say you read.
I think I read all of them. As I said, all the strikers have passed away. And that was actually another reason I think I wrote the book, is that somebody has to keep telling the story because none of the participants are with us to tell it anymore. And of course, you know, I used a lot of accounts from the Flint Journal. Frances Perkins left a great oral history. She was the first woman in a presidential cabinet, and she was very instrumental in helping to settle the strike. Her argument with Alfred P. Sloan. That's in her oral history. He backs out on an agreement to negotiate with the strikers, and she called him a rotter and told him he was going to choke on his money and go to hell. He said, "You can't talk to me. I'm Alfred Sloan. I've got $70 million and I made it all myself."
Well, that's not exactly true. It sounded good at the moment, probably to right. him, but I don't yeah. think it landed with much effect to the audience he was speaking to.
I went to New York, to Columbia University, to look at the Francis Perkins papers.
There were also three brothers involved in this.
Right. The Ruthers, mostly two. It was Victor and Roy Ruther. Walter Ruther was busy in Detroit. He had his own strike going on.
One of the places it was Fisher Body Number 1.
Yeah.
Which is a iconic historic auto factory that appeared in Roger and Me. And it showed the falling, I guess, is or felling of the tower, the water tower, that was symbolic of the plant going away.
Right.
The workers gathered in another place. Tell us where that was.
Just had a storefront across the street where they were gathered for meetings. And there was a red light above the door to let them know. They called it, I think, the flicker or the flasher, to let them know that there was a meeting going on. And that's where Bob Travis, who was the organizer in charge of the strike, that's where he declared that this was the time they were going to go on strike, because they'd wanted to delay it until after the new year when Frank Murphy was sworn in. You know, he was the New Deal governor of Michigan, and they thought he was going to be sympathetic to the union cause. A couple of days before the new year, first of all, another sit-down strike kind of broke out in Cleveland, and then they were hearing that GM was going to move the dies from Flint to Grand Rapids. And Fisher One contained dies that stamped out body parts that were used in GM cars all over the country. So if they could capture that plant and control those dies, then they could stop GM production everywhere, and the company would have to negotiate with. And I think that storefront is still there. I mean, there is a storefront right across the street. I think that building is still there.
There was also a building called the Pengally Building, which was downtown.
Right.
And there's a road that's just three blocks from this factory called Pengally Road. What do you know about the Pengally Building?
An office building, been demolished since then. And that's where the union had its headquarters. You know, they'd have rallies there. They'd have meetings there. And I think the strike kitchen was there. They would put on plays there, show movies there. So it was just the nerve center of the whole strike operation.
Yeah. Now, they had a women's brigade, right?
Right. Well, it started out as, ladies auxiliary. And there was a woman named Janura Johnson. And I think some people in Flint think there should be a statue of her downtown, like there's a statue of, you know, Buick and Durant and all those guys.
Well, they're making progress. They have one now, Rosie the Riveter. So they're working their way to
Janura Johnson. Yeah. Yes. So she was someone who, she was married to an auto worker, a striker named Kermit Johnson at that time. And, you know, she was someone who'd been involved in socialist causes. She invited Norman Thomas to speak in Flint, and her family read all the socialist publications. And she went down to the Pengally Building to volunteer. They said, "Well, we can put you to work in the kitchen." And she didn't want to work in the kitchen. So she organized a picket line, and she had her 2-year-old son carrying a sign that said, "My daddy strikes for us little tykes." And then after the Battle of the Running Bulls, when the police attacked Fisher 2, she encouraged women to, you know, run down to the plant and interpose their bodies between the strikers and the police and protect their men. And so she thought that the women ought to play, you know, there was as much at stake for the women as the men. So the women ought to play a significant role in the strike as the men did. I mean, there were women working in Fisher 1 and the cut and sew department, but they were told to leave as soon as the sit down strike broke out because, you know, the union didn't want any rumors about what might be going on between men and women in the plant. That would have just undermined support from the home front. So the next day she started the Women's Emergency Brigade. She was the captain, and they wore red berets and they wore red armbands, and they all carried billy clubs underneath their coats. And when the union tried to take over Chevy 4, which was an engine plant, and that was really going to shut down the whole company. And there was a diversionary battle at Chevy 9, and the plant police fired tear gas. And so the Women's Emergency Brigade broke all the windows to let the tear gas escape. So they went into action. The next day, the Flint Journal, I think, was reporting that crazed women had broken windows for no apparent reason.
Well, that wasn't true. It wouldn't be the first time they got it wrong.
Okay.
I want to ask you some questions here. First one is, what effect do you think this strike had on Flint?
Well, I think that for a long time, they said there was more of a spirit of union militancy in Flint than other cities. I think I'd read that strikes took longer to settle in Flint than they did elsewhere. But certainly it had an effect on Flint. You know, as late as 1980, Flint was the city with the highest wages for workers under young workers in America. And that was because you went to work in the shop and you went to work at the union wage. So Flint had several prosperous decades following the sit-down strike as a result of the sit-down strike.
The UAW was not a socialist organization.
No, but there was some of the organizers were socialists and even communists. Wyndham Mortimer, who was the first organizer sent to Flint to sort of organize, put together a union, he was a communist. And so was Bob Travis, who was the sort of the general and the architect of the sit-down strike.
So the history of socialism in Flint dates back quite a few years.
Well, yeah, I think Flint had a socialist mayor in the early 20th century, and then Mott ran against it. The establishment, decided to get its act together, and they ran Mott against him, and Mott was elected mayor.
In 1911, Thomas Minton was elected along with three aldermen to the Flint City Council, and they were running on wages, hours, and working conditions.
There were some tough times going on. A lot of workers have been laid off.
There were people living in tar paper shacks in the shadow of Buick.
Right, right. I mean, they couldn't build enough housing for all the workers who were streaming into Flint for these good jobs.
Right. Well, the socialist idea, let's follow that for just a second here. You're quite knowledgeable about labor history. The socialists had a whole agenda, and it involved a lot more than work. Part of it had to do with the fact that there were all these men. Flint went from like 6,000 or 7,000 people to 90,000 people in less than 10 years. In fact, at one point, it was the fastest growing city in America. Some of their issues had to do with they couldn't take a bath because there wasn't any place to get warm water. They didn't have any recreational activities and so on. Industrialists at the time, they weren't too keen on the idea that these people were trying to end child labor, because that was one of their platforms.
Right.
They were keen on a whole bunch of stuff, but that was one of them. But in the end, the workers of Flint voted for the guy that had just sold his company to General Motors. He had to be one of the largest shareholders at General Motors at the time.
They gave him a 5% share to entice him to move his company to Flint. And of course, that ended up being worth multi-millions of dollars.
Once he got to Flint, he initially sold 49% of his company, and then after he got elected mayor, he sold the rest.
Okay.
They didn't like the union. I mean, they didn't like what they saw was the beginning of organized labor in Flint.
Right. Well, most industrialists don't.
And that theme has continued to this day. It's not really any different, doesn't seem like. In those days, Charles Mott was more in their face. Mm-hmm. And they voted for him until they didn't, which was only a few years later. 1915 was when he was defeated. You said you wrote the book because you think the story needs to keep being told.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because it's not taught in school, or why isn't it being told?
Well, I don't think it's very well known outside of Michigan or even outside of Flint. It's the foundation of the United Auto Workers, which was the flagship union in the United States. I mean, this was the union that set the wages and set the benefits and set the terms for industrial workers all over the country. And it was sort of the key to this great 20th century middle class that we had. It was interesting to me that, these workers who were trying to start a union at Amazon in Alabama, how similar their concerns were to the concerns of the sit-down strikers. They wanted a more humane pace of labor. They didn't want to have to peeing in bottles on the job. They wanted more job security. They wanted more say in the workforce. And of course, that effort failed. What I thought, and I read an interesting article by a guy named Harold Meyerson about how today the unions are becoming a white-collar movement. They're always thought of as a blue-collar movement. But workers who feel like they're replaceable, who feel like the company can just move out of town or pull the rug out from under them if they start a union, they're more reluctant to unionize than, you know, professionals who either are not as replaceable or feel like they can find a job somewhere else. So it's a strange moment in the history of the labor movement.
And one of the things that was a legacy of the sit-down strikes in Flint was that they celebrated a strike.
Right. And White Shirt Day. I went to a couple White Shirt Days.
Okay. Celebrating a strike is an odd thing. I mean, most people don't want to strike. That is the most union people I've ever met in my life. They prefer not to have strikes.
Right.
Why should the union celebrate this strike?
I guess for the same reason that Christians celebrate Christmas. This is where it all began. This is where it all began for the UAW.
That's very good. Why a white shirt?
They wanted to show that they were as good as management. You know, the foremen wore white shirts, so then all the workers wore.
Let me understand what you're saying. They have an event in memory of the strikers and all these heroic people, and then they all wear white shirts to this event. Is that it?
Right. Well, but they would originally wear white shirts to work, and I think they still do in the plant.
So the day of the strike.
On February 11th, the day the strike was settled.
And is this just in Flint or all over the place?
I think they wanted to make it a nationwide thing, but it's mainly in Flint. I mean, I never really heard about it being celebrated in Lansing. But every year it's at a different union hall in Flint or in the Flint area. And, you know, they have politicians come there and union officials, people come make speeches. They hold hands and sing Solidarity Forever. And then they have women dressed up like when the women in the Women's Emergency Brigade, and they're serving bean soup and apples and bread, which is what the strikers were eating in the plants. They want to say that this is a remembrance of the sacrifices that the sit-down strikers made for the prosperity they have.
Do you think that tradition will carry on?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I went to a couple in recent years and they mentioned that there were no original strikers or members of the Women's Emergency Brigade left anymore. I mean, I guess as long as cars are made in Flint, however much longer that is, I think it will carry on.
They don't make cars in Flint anymore. They just make trucks.
Okay. Well, as long as vehicles are made in the vehicle city.
What do you hope is the impact of your book?
You know, I want people to see what can happen when workers stand together, unite. And I want to show that when the government supports workers, then they succeed. I mean, it wouldn't have succeeded without the support of Frank Murphy and Francis Perkins and Franklin D. Roosevelt. You know, Frank Murphy could have sent in the National Guard to evict the strikers from the plants as the court had ordered them. But instead, he sent the National Guard as a peacekeeping force. He said, you know, get in the streets, surround the plants, get between the police and the strikers and make sure there's no more violence. You know, President Biden delivered a speech that some people thought was the most pro-union speech they'd ever heard from an American. He supported the workers in Alabama and said every worker has a right to belong to a union. You know, as I said before, some workers just have so much economic anxiety now, they're afraid to join a union. And I want Flint to be known for something other than the water crisis. How about that?
The strike was one thing that's known for that many people who were trying to market the city thought was a negative. How would you respond to that? They said, why did we celebrate a strike and put it on our expressway? Why do we celebrate a strike? And that is supposedly a message to business, don't come here.
As a result of the strike, there was more of a spirit of labor militancy in Flint than in other cities. And some people in the 80s, they thought that was the reason that GM was pulling out of Flint. They thought that they were getting revenge for the sit-down strike 50 years later. You know, the decline of GM employment in Flint is pretty much at the same level as it is everywhere else in the country.
Let me ask you about Flint as we see it today. You said you spent a lot of time in Flint. That's right?
Yeah.
What was it about your visit to Flint while you were writing this book that surprised you about the city?
Well, you know, I just thought it was fascinating, sort of the progression that the industries followed. You know, Flint started out as a logging town, lumbering town. And when the lumber was played out, they had this wood. And, okay, what are we going to do with this? Well, we'll make carriages. And so then Flint was the number one carriage manufacturer. And then from 1900, they saw that, you know, these guys like R.E. Olds and Henry Ford were putting motors on carriages. And they said, well, we need to do that. We need to get with the 20th century. So then Flint became an automaking town. So I was fascinated by that for sure.
The Flint people, some of them, like to call themselves Flintstones.
Right. Well, that was popularized by Mateen Cleaves and Morris Peterson and Charlie Bell when they played for the Michigan State Spartans. They called themselves the Flintstones. And I before that, I'd heard Flintoid, but I think Flintstones is the one that's really caught on and been embraced locally. Do you call yourself a Flintstone?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What does that represent to you? But what's it mean to be a Flintstone?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than a moniker. It's more than a nickname. It has more to do, I think, with something else.
What's that?
There's some theories about the Flintstone concept here that I'm exploring. And the theory is this. They're tough. They're resilient. You know, they have strength. They're loyal. Once they won the national championship, they were one other thing, and they were winners.
Right.
The townspeople here began to identify with this idea. They articulated what people in Flint. I mean, before that, people were looking for Texas. You know, they weren't talking about how wonderful Flint was. So now, when you talk to these Flintstones, many of them will say they believe that those qualities, those character, the ethos, if the philosophy and so on, that it's embedded in the fabric of the city. And many feel that they've acquired those things by being part of Flint, by being raised here, that's what you learn when you're little.
Okay.
How is that different than what you've observed in other blue collar cities that you wrote about in your works?
I think you find it in other places. I think you'd find it, say, in a place like Youngstown, Ohio. That's another blue collar city that's been through some tough times. I think you'd find it in Cleveland. You'd find it in Detroit. So okay. I think it is a common thread in blue collar cities that endured tough times during the Rust Belt era. It makes a lot of sense.
And you wrote this Blue Sky book, which I was fascinated by. You talk about an optimism in that book.
Right.
Can you explain what that is?
You know, I kind of meant the title as sort of a play on words, you know, nothing but blue skies. That's what I think I got the idea from a guy in South Chicago. And after the mill closed, he said, I looked up one day and I saw a blue sky and I thought the world had ended because there was no more smoke coming out of the chimneys. It's the end of something, but it's also a blank slate. Of course, you know, nothing but blue skies. That's a very optimistic kind of song. Build something new.
There have been some studies that show that deindustrialization in these cities that we're making reference to, that it gives rise to a certain optimism that may be unrealistic.
Sure.
Have you heard of that?
You know, I did see people who thought, you know, they could build something brand new, I guess, out of the ashes. And I don't know how successful it always was. I mean, I think there's some optimism in Flint. Flint's got a new farmer's market. That's something, you know, people are optimistic about.
When I talk to these people on this podcast, many of them tell me that they believe that Flint has a certain resilience.
Yeah. I mean, it has to. I mean, it's lost more than half its population, I think, since its peak. I think you'd have to be resilient to stay in Flint, to want to stay in Flint and to want to keep trying to build something there.
The history of the city is such that they've overcome a lot of ups and downs. The automobile economy, by definition, is an economy that is a roller coaster.
Right, right. I can't imagine what's going to come back. No other industry where there's more value added than in making automobiles. That's why it was so lucrative for such a long time. So I don't know that Flint's ever going to find anything to replace that. It's hard to imagine Flint being as prosperous, say, as it was in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s.
What do you think that they did in battling for their town way back then?
Yeah, they always say, even today, that it wasn't about money. It was about, you know, it was about dignity. And I think that they established a lot of precedents or things that workers take for granted today. You know, before the sit-down strike, they would say that there was no job security. That you had to bring food to your foreman. Or you'd have to paint his house or throw him a party. And if you didn't, he could just, you know, kick you out. And his brother-in-law would be working in your place the next day. And, you know, they really didn't like workers over 40 because they couldn't keep up with the pace of the assembly line. You know, after the sit-down strike ended, the contracts at layoffs were going to be by seniority. And that's something, you know, we we take for granted today, but that was something that was not at all in place at General Motors before the sit-down strike.
We still have General Motors in Flint. They didn't leave. We still have one of the most significant factories in their bag of tricks. We make hot selling trucks.
Right.
And there are still 7,000 workers there in those two plants. Is there something different today about the workers than there were in 1937?
They're more prosperous. I hope they're more satisfied with their working conditions than they were back then. And even today, a direct result of what the sit-down strikers did, 85 years ago.
Anything else? Are they willing to fight for what they've got?
I mean, I remember talking to a guy. He was a guy in Lansing, and he'd been participating in the 1970 strike. You know, that was when they got the 30 and out. He said, well, after that, we had everything. There was nothing more to fight for. I think maybe they're more likely to feel like that now that they've got it all. There was that strike a few years ago. There was a pretty significant strike a few years ago.
You're talking about the strike at the metal fab that shut down General Motors?
Well, that was one. I think that was in 1998. This was the one, I think it was just two or three years ago when GM went on strike, the whole company.
How is Flint, Michigan so different than any of these other places? Janesville, Wisconsin was a company town.
Yeah.
A General Motors company town. And but for some demographic differences, it probably was the same city.
Right.
In a different place. Janesville, Wisconsin, they went home and waited until the people in Flint sat down.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole UAW hierarchy had just decided that Flint was where they wanted to, that Flint was the key city. Flint was the city they were targeting because, Flint had the most GM plants. And Flint had those key GM plants and had those key dies and those key engines. So if they could organize Flint, if they could shut down Flint, then they could organize the whole company. So I think it's just a matter of, being so central and so important to General Motors is why this happened in Flint.
Let me get back to my original question. So we have a whole bunch of places where yeah. General Motors operates. How is Flint different today than other places?
Because it was so dependent on General Motors. I mean, I think I read like 2/3 of the people in Flint got a paycheck from General Motors one way or the other. I'm from Lansing, and Lansing, had a significant GM presence, but it's also the state capital, and it also had Michigan State University. So the state employment was a three-legged stool, campus, cars, and capital. But in Flint, it was a one-legged stool.
You started out talking to me about the willingness to fight by these workers, their willingness yeah. to stand up and stand up for what they believe. Is Flint different in that respect, that it has a more intensely activist mindset than these other places?
Can I read a from a guy named Gordon Young that he might have been on your show? And I think he sums it up pretty well. It's a blurb he wrote. Let's see. Midnight Vehicle City captures the Flint of today through the captivating story of the city's past. McClellan reveals the toughness, determination, and even recklessness that fueled auto workers and their families in 1936 as they took on a corporate giant, the military, and an unsympathetic press. If you ever wonder why current Flint residents haven't given up, this book is an engaging reminder that fighting seemingly unwinnable battles is part of this city's DNA.
Some experts that I've talked to in political science have studied more yeah. recently in the water crisis. And that's exactly what they describe. Actually, uh-huh. that's what they found, research. They call it intense localism. It's a culture that activists develop in this area, which fuels mostly fights about local things, bad water.
Right.
Bad working conditions.
Right.
You go to Seattle if you want to see somebody fight about the monetary system of the world.
Uh-huh.
You come to Flint if you want to see what happens every day in their lives.
Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think that helped to fuel the resolve of the strikers?
I think that's probably where it came from. That's where it was established. Probably a lot of cities where a sit-down strike could have been successful, but Flint was where it happened. And that success was what established this tradition of activism that you still see in Flint.
You have a magnificent list of books. Tell us about that.
The one I wrote before this one was called How to Speak Midwestern. I wrote that for a small publisher called Belt Publishing in Ohio, but it turned out to be my best-selling book. It got a review in the New York Times, and that sells a lot of books. So, it was about the Midwestern you know, Midwesterners like to believe we don't have an accent. You know, regional accents are part of regional identity, and part of being a Midwesterner is believing you don't have a Midwestern accent. But I broke down the Midwestern accent, and I included a lot of regional terms, like Michigan terms, you know, Coney Dog and Party Store. And I've written another book called Nothing But Blue Skies, and it was sort of a history of the Rust Belt, and I spent some time in Flint to research that one.
I appreciate it, your time.
Thank you for promoting Midnight in Vehicle City. And you can get a copy, and I signed some book plates at Totem Books. So I think they've got some plenty of copies there.
Okay, very good. We'll post that on our website, and we'll make some links to your other book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's the end of our podcast. Thank you for joining us today. This is Arthur Bush. You're listening to Radio Free Flint. We hope that you will sign up for our newsletter at radiofreeflint.media. You'll rate us, review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to thank Dan Hall and David Norris for allowing us to use the song 1937, When Spirits Burned, written about the Flint sit-down strike. The song contains excerpts of a speech from the late former president of the UAW, Walter P. Reuther. Spirits burned was passed today to me. Damn the pinks and all the fakes who tried to make us go. We stand for right and we'll win this fight and match them toe to toe. So bring them on. We're waiting here to fight or talk, you choose. And while we hold our brother's hand, the worker will never lose. Is there a truer heart today than those who took a stand? In 1937, cold, the sit-down strike would end. They left their wives and babies uncertainty, and what they earned when spirits burned was passed today to me.
We need to let our younger people know what it was like in the early days, how we were beaten up by the gangsters and the underworld goons, and how we were shot at, and how we were intimidated. But we overcame all of that power of these great corporations, and we demonstrated that when free men and women are united in the solidarity of human brotherhood, when they are united by common commitment in pursuit of common objectives, that there is no power in the world that can stop the forward march of free men thus united.